This message comes from NPR sponsor, Noom. Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out The Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car, you should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. Don't settle. Find love at first drive. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Allianz Travel Insurance. A travel delay can cost you more than just time. Learn why 70 million American travelers protect their trips with Allianz Travel Insurance. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. At some point, I'm willing to bet you've seen Paul Dooley playing a dad. Maybe in Breaking Away, about the small-town teenager who's obsessed with bike racing. Dooley played his dad. Or in 16 Candles, where he played Molly Ringwald's.
Why do you think you're a dork? I don't think you're a dork. I don't think Mom thinks you're a dork.
Mike thinks I'm a dork.
Mike is a dork.
So am I.
Well, if it's any consolation, I love you. And if this guy can't see in you all the beautiful and wonderful things that I see, then he's got the problem.
I know. It just hurts.
That's why they call them crushes. If they were easy, they'd call them something else.
He played Julia Roberts' dad in Runaway Bride.
You know the old saying, you're not losing a daughter? Well, I'd like to. Maggie may not be Hale's longest running joke, but she is certainly the fastest.
Good one, Dad.
You know one of these dads. Maybe you know all these dads. Paul Dooley, it is safe to say, is a dad legend. But he's also much more than that. He was in the original Broadway cast of The Odd Couple. He was in The Second City with Nichols and May. He was a regular in Robert Altman movies. He did stand-up on The Tonight Show. He co-created The Electric Company. At one point, and this is true, he recorded an entire album of book humor. It was called Booked Solid.
I personally like books that are kind of, I don't know, safe, like Roget's Thesaurus. These things are kind of embarrassing to carry around. And I have them with me always, you know. It's particularly difficult on the subways, you know. Because I know last week, during the rush hour, I was on the subway and I happened to notice this sweet little old lady near me. And I felt very bad to be sitting down. Especially on her. So I turned to the guy on me and I said, "Excuse me, sir, I'd like to get up." And he said, "So would I." I said, "Why don't you?" He said, "Well, I'm holding a lady's packages for her." I said, "Why don't you give them back?" He said, "She's sitting on them." Well, I said, "Why don't we all get up?" And so we did, which finally allowed the little old lady to get up off the little old man.
Booked. Solid. It's all about books. Seriously, Paul Dooley has done it all. He's 95. He's still working. His book is called Movie Dad, Finding Myself and My Family on Screen and Off. It's about his 7 decades in show business. It's also about some of the heartbreaking trials he went through off screen. I'm so excited to welcome the legend Paul Dooley on Bullseye. Let's get right into it. Paul Dooley, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You, before we went on the air, started talking about your long career in television commercials and radio commercials. How did you get into the commercial business?
I'd give you a little backstory. I was in New York for 9 years, kind of just barely making the rent. I'd do a little off-Broadway play for a month or 2 weeks or 2 days. And if I got enough of them, I'd go on unemployment for 26 weeks. But it was just squeaking by it, making $3,000 a year in the 50s, in the early 50s. I could never get a commercial audition. And finally, I got a few commercial auditions, but I kept failing at them. I said to myself, well, I was told I was the best actor in my college. How come I can't do something that's 60 seconds long? Well, who knows, but maybe you have anxiety when you're auditioning. I didn't think I did, but so I must have gone for 40 auditions, never got one. And I thought, how bad can I be? It's 60 seconds. And then one day I got a commercial. The client loved it. It was for Fab dishwashing liquid. They signed me to a contract, and I made a $40,000 a year contract after living on $3,000 a year. And that's how I got into commercials. Then, although I had an agent later, and he said, well, you're going to be overexposed with that product, so nobody will want to use you. The opposite became true because there were only three networks and no cable at that time. So I was on every day, often, and each one of them doing stuff for a woman's audience, like dishwashing things. So then I couldn't do enough commercials. And also, there was a time where there were no black actors in commercials, Puerto Ricans, Jews, all of those. It was just us white guys. So I turned out to be a WASP who could buy the product, sell the product, be the neighbor. So I was just constantly in commercials.
We found a Fab commercial. It's from the early 50s. I'm pretty sure this is you. You look different now than you did in 1952 or whatever.
No kidding.
So let's hear it.
Good morning, ma'am. Allow me to introduce you to a brand new detergent.
Oh, do you give free demonstrations?
Yes, ma'am.
Please come in.
New Fab is power blasted under more than 300 pounds of pressure per second.
Can I see it?
Oh, the package. Yes, of course.
Oh, it's the new blue box.
It's all new inside, too. Not a powder, not a crystal, but a compression of cleaning energy in each tiny bead, which gives New Fab the penetrating power to get your toughest wash, not just surface clean, but...
Clean clear through?
Clean clear through, right. Now for your laundry.
Help yourself.
All that? How does it look?
Well, it looks clean clear through, like my usual wash.
It does?
Sure. I bought New Fab last week.
First of all, thank you for the mime show.
I look at that today and I seem like I'm so overacting, but it's just what they wanted him to be.
There's a couple solid bits in there. There's a part where you sort of trip over something that's pretty funny.
Well, at the time, it seemed to be what was kind of happening in commercials. They're a little corny, you know. By a year later, I was never talking that loud. I was never trying that hard, and I was very subtle. I just, as long as we're at this point, I need to tell you this. With radio, on camera, and voiceover, I've done 641 commercials.
That's a lot of commercials.
It is.
Can I have a few?
They're products that don't even exist anymore. My wife is younger than me, who isn't, but she remembers being a kid and seeing me in a lab coat at a little fish tank. Inside is a tomato plant, and there are clams hanging on it. It was a new thing called clamato juice, and she's 26 years younger than me, but she remembers it as a kid. It's vivid. It's such a silly idea.
Well, clamato's what you ask for, the one you raise your glass for, the pick-me-up that picks you up, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you never did one for powders or crystals. I hate powders and crystals.
I can't even. I do have a list because you may remember a lot of people have this or had it. A Week at a Glance book this big, a tiny little book. Well, if I went to there's a little square in each day. But if I went to J. Walter Thompson ad agency, I'd put JWT because we all knew the initials, all of us commercial actors. And if I got the job, I'd put an X by it. Years later, in a box in my garage, I found those things and counted it all up and it showed how many commercials I was in. But I linked up with another actor when I was in Second City. We sort of knew how to read each other's minds. And we overlapped sentences, and they used to think improvisers sounded more like people talking than people who left a little gap for the edit. So we were often hired that way. So he and I, of that 640, went about 550 were with this one guy. And we were both WASP. We thought alike. I could read his mind. He could read mine. We could lead each other into bits. We were both straight men and the comedians.
Were you happy to be a commercial actor? Were you cool
I was
with that?
So thrilled with the money. I didn't care about being in a movie. I didn't try to get auditions for Broadway shows or off-Broadway shows because I was a rich man suddenly compared to other actors. So I was actually, for the money, I was thrilled. I mean, it's not artistic. But even in a minute thing, if you're good and you have good comedy timing and character, that's also creative. You're still an actor. So I paid no attention to plays or movies or anything. And I had a family with three children, so it was great for me.
I'm sorry that I'm so focused on the portion of your career before you became a famous person. It's just you did so many interesting things. You also were a children's clown for a time, doing magic tricks.
When I couldn't join Equity, SAG, and AFTRA, the three unions, I had learned to juggle in college and did some magic. So I used that to do a clown. But I knew I couldn't fill an hour or half hour, which is basically a mime. I'm not Marcel Marceau. So I hired an actor, and I bought him a tailcoat, and my wife at the time put a red lapel over the lapel. So he would spell me when I'd go off stage, and then we'd do bits together. Then I would do birthday parties for $25, but it would take me no more than an hour. But then there was some other work that you'd stand on the street for like 8 hours or 12 hours in front of an opening of a supermarket and hand out coupons. You were only there to attract a crowd. So a guy came to me one day, a friend. He said, I know a friend. He has a wife and two kids, and he's a good actor, but he's starting out. I wonder if you could give him some of that clown work you do as a stooge on the street. Sure, have him come over to my house. It's Alan Alda. The only thing I knew about him was his father was Robert Alda, Sky Masterson on Broadway and Guys and Dolls. Well, I said, yeah, I have pieces of costumes. I gave him a jumpsuit, which it's from the ankles to the, from the feet to the wrists, this one, a zipper up the front. By the time you do that, you're 90% of a clown. But I didn't have much money to put together even my own clown act, but I said, he said, what about the face? I said, I can loan you some clown white. It's a zinc oxide kind of makeup. Or you don't have to use a white face. You could do it other ways. But I said, go to the dime store and buy a little rubber ball. Cut a triangle for your nose. Get a piece of elastic, put it around, and tie a knot on the inside. Go to the secondhand store and find a woman's hat that's either red, green, or blue. Use that. And to make it look like you have a wig, hanging down from it is yarn, and it looks like curly hair. Don't ever take the hat off, though. But I, for pennies, a dollar or two, I helped him put together a little clown act like that, too.
In that time, you were cast in the original New York production of the Threepenny Opera.
Yeah.
What role did you play?
His name is Walt Dreary, and Mac the Knife had a gang, and there were four of us. I got the job because John Astin, who was in another play with me for $5 a week off Broadway, then he got the job. They said, Actors' Equity allows us to have, we have to use Actors' Equity members, but we're allowed to have a dispensation of ordering like four actors who are not in the union for small parts. So he gave them my name, and he played Ready Money Matt as one of McKeith's thieves, and I was Walt Dreary, and we had a scene here, a scene there. But it was great to be in a play, and it was at the Theatre de Lys, and I only stayed for 3 months because I had a job I liked better, working with Carol Burnett in the summer theater. But it ran 7 years off Broadway.
What did you think of it when you got cast in it? Like, what did your friend tell you? I mean, he must have just called you and said, I've got a job for you. But like,
he said he recommended me to the director. I went over and met him and said, sure. Yeah. I was glad to get a job because, of course, it's a play in England. It's called The Gay Something. But anyway, it was in Germany on a film with Lottie Lenya. And then a movie with her. And then when it came off Broadway, she was in the movie 20. Now she's 40 or 50, and she's playing the same part, Pirate Jenny. But it had a lot. It's Kurt Weill is the guy who wrote the music. But it's thrilling to be in it, just to stand in the wings and hear the songs.
I mean, it's an incredible show. Like, but it's also not like much else. You know what I mean?
No. The robber, I forget the name in England, but it was called The Gay Something. But it has a whole history. And Lottie Lynn is wonderful. She made records, Kurt Wilde's her husband.
It's sort of terrifying, too.
Yeah. She had a song where she talked about the people who had always slighted her. That you gentlemen may gawk while I'm scrubbing the floor. And I'll be scrubbing the floor while you're gawking, but maybe once, and it's called the Black Freighter. You've been trapped out at sea, and they chain you up and bring them to me, and I'll say, now I got you. Beautiful song, the Black Freighter.
Ship, the Black Freighter.
Turns around in the harbor, and on it is me.
We have to go for a quick break. We've got so much more to get into with Paul Dooley. Around the time that he got some of his most iconic parts, playing dads in movies like Breaking Away and 16 Candles, Dooley's own family life was falling apart. We'll talk about what that was like and how he's picked up the pieces. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at massmutual.com.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Paul Dooley. Dooley is an actor who has appeared in movies like 16 Candles, Runaway Bride, and Breaking Away. He's also a comedian and writer and co-created the kids' show, The Electric Company. Paul Dooley is now 95 years old. He is still working and still as sharp and funny as ever. He recently wrote a memoir called Movie Dad, Finding Myself and My Family, On Screen and Off. Let's get back into the rest of our conversation. You also, for a time, worked the door at the Village Vanguard, right?
I did.
Who was on stage when you were working?
Well, I have a little story. My friends say to me, you tell me that you watch Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and the name of a bunch of Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, for nothing? I said, no, I watch Professor Irwin Corey, Orson Bean, and two or three other comic, Lenny Bruce. I didn't care about the jazz guys. My head was into comedy. And several times he was arrested at the end of his set, Lenny Bruce. The cops would just come to listen and they'd take him out. He wasn't using the F word or anything, but he was making fun of the Pope and the Catholics. So he was often taken out and put in a paddy wagon and became well known for being arrested. And one night, two people I never heard of came there just to do one night, did about 10 minutes. It was Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And so now I'm able to hear them over and over and over for a week. But a manager named Jack Rollins, who's very famous, he was the manager for Woody Allen, a lot of people, the greatest personal manager in New York, with taste. Well, within a few evenings at the Vanguard, he brought them uptown to the Blue Angel for a week. And within a month, they were talked about all over New York, like the rage of the intelligentsia. Then later they had a Broadway show, The Two and Only. No, that was Bob and Ray. It was called Mike Nichols and Elaine May.
An Evening With, yeah.
Well, they were my idols, you know, because it's so brilliant. And I have the thrill. I've had the great experience of being directed by both Mike and Elaine. Mike for The Odd Couple on Broadway, and Elaine in an off-Broadway play she wrote called Adaptation. So that was the thrill of my lifetime. It was like loving Buster Keaton when I was 15 and working with him doing a commercial for 2 days 30 years later.
Let's talk a little bit about your film career. You had little parts in movies here and there.
Yeah.
A few lines at a time.
Yeah, they weren't huge parts.
What was the first big part that you had?
Breaking Away. The stars of it were four boys who rode bicycles. But the de facto star could have been my guy. Because everything, this is a fabulous writer, Steve Tessich, who won an Oscar for the script. And everything my character said got huge, huge laughs. I was playing my father, and it was just right up my alley.
It's one of my favorite movies, and I'm going to play a little clip from it. This is one of the, you've got a couple big comedy moments in the movie, but this is a pretty sincere one. So the movie is about kind of this generational shift with your character's son sort of aspiring to a world outside of the working class town in which they live. And
hoping my kid will go farther.
Yeah. And you trying to figure out basically what that means for you and your generation. And in this clip, the two of you are walking through the college campus, which is, you know, the college is the sort of big class signifier in the town.
And I had been a stone mason.
Exactly.
I cut the stone for this building.
You did?
Yeah. I was one fine stone cutter. Mike's dad, Moocher's, Cyril's, all of us. Well, Cyril's dad. Never mind. Thing of it was, I loved it. I was young and slim and strong. I was damn proud of my work. And the buildings went up. When they were finished, the damnedest thing happened. It was like buildings is too good for us.
Were you confident when you started doing dramatic work that all this comedy stuff that you had done before could translate?
I was really afraid of doing comedy for a long, long time. I mean, I'm sorry, I was so into comedy. I didn't want to play a straight part. Altman saw me in the Jules Feiffer Review and hired me for a wedding. I was going to be married. I was married to Carol Burnett, who was an old friend of mine anyway, so it was good.
That is the film A Wedding.
What? The film A Wedding. And so I had an epiphany. He lets you attend dailies. It was a theme of his. Most actors, most directors don't want you there. They want to be able to say, can you get a shot of her where her nose doesn't look so big? You want to have the actors in the room. But he didn't like that. He wanted his actress to be there, and we all were. And I forget what I was tying this to.
You were figuring out about that you could do drama.
Yeah. When I saw those dailies, I said to myself, I can do drama. I can do serious acting. I never cared about it or, you know. Then I said, oh, I get it. If you have a good timing, it's still good timing if you're doing drama. So that makes you a pretty good actor. Good timing is great for even this most serious actor. Look at Orson Welles or somebody.
You mentioned that you were, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters playing your dad in Breaking Away. I think the dads that you played were often like that dad in Breaking Away, distant, recalcitrant,
yeah.
Maybe grumpy.
Yeah.
And often they're the element that you bring to the role, or the special thing about the role is being able to sell that and sell something a little warmer too.
Yeah, it has a little bit of a twist. In other words, you're appearing to be a grumpy guy, but then when you're talking to your daughter or your son, you become pretty warm, as you say.
Did you have that with your dad?
No, he was nothing like that. He hardly ever spoke to me. He was a guy who, on his own hook, built an entire house without any help. I didn't know how he did that. I thought everybody's father built his own house with a third grade education and very bad eyesight. How does he build a cabinet with a quarter of an inch or half an inch? You sure have a plumb line, but how did he do all this? He roofed the house. He dug, spent 2 years dug the basement and all that stuff. But many years later in therapy, I'm telling my therapist about my father. He says, well, he may have been a man with no formal education, but it sounds like he was highly intelligent. Because how did he do all this stuff without any help? No, didn't study any trade, didn't go to carpentry school. He just did it. I never really knew how. But I never saw him embrace my mother, never saw him kiss my mother, never put his arm around me. He just was busy working. Come home from the factory and go to his little workshop and continue to do things. I didn't hold it against him for some reason as a kid because I didn't know what the opposite would be. I had no way of knowing how most fathers are. So most fathers are like that. So that's who I played in certain movies. But I could also turn around and be a nicer father, like 16 Candles, for example.
When you shot those father-son scenes in Breaking Away, your kids were gone from your life.
Yeah, that's right.
They had been, when you were divorced from your second wife, yeah. She kidnapped the kids.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been brutally difficult.
It was. But I think, as they say, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Dealing with it, I knew I had to get beyond it. But you don't really get beyond it. I'm in touch with these two kids now. But there's a ghost of their mother in the back of their mind. They don't, they still have to have a funny allegiance to their caretaker.
You didn't tell almost anyone after you looked for your kids and went to court, got sole custody.
Yeah.
After a while, you just figured whatever you could do would be a trauma, you know, similar to the trauma of them having been kidnapped.
I would tear them away from the only mother that ever known. How's that going to help him? It's a double trauma. So I just stepped back. I said, when they want to find me, they'll find me. I kept my same apartment, same phone number in New York. And then an anonymous person called me up and told me one of them was working in the animal shelter in Madison, Wisconsin. An anonymous person. I never knew what it was. I have a theory that she was a friend of my wife, and she heard the story. But then maybe they had a falling out. And she said, well, those kids deserve to know who their father is. But I don't know.
Did they know that you were their father?
Yes, they did. My son Adam went to see, I don't know how it was known, maybe he told a friend of his who I was. And he said, there's a movie coming out now and your father's in it, was Breaking Away. So he goes to see it, and he had to, in a scene where I'm hugging Dennis Christopher, he has to leave the theater because that was him who should be getting that hug, and he wasn't getting it. And went back and saw it again. But it just was amazing. And my experience was, I'm playing my father in my persona. I'm hugging a guy the age of my son Adam. So if I'm the father and this is my son, if he's my son, who am I? It got all mixed up about embracing my son. My real son I couldn't find. I embraced him like he was my real son. So it had a lot of layers to it.
How old were you when your kids found you?
Well, they were going about 10 years. I was probably 40, 42, 43. I'd done a lot of movies. Oh, wait a minute. I was in Malta for 6 months doing Popeye. And I would have not taken that job for all that many months if my kids couldn't find me. So that was 1980. Probably a couple of years later is when we all hooked up. But I was probably in my mid-40s. But I always looked younger than I did. Even now, I look younger than I am.
I mean, you had your career completely transforming because you were making those movies with Robert Altman. You're making Breaking Away. At the same time as you are, and you're giving up your previous career in a way. You know what I mean? Like, you had had this long career making radio and television ads and doing stage work. And in a way, movies and TV were taking you away from that.
Yeah, what I didn't mind because, of course, movies are more important to the audience, to the public, than commercials.
But, like, everything must have been upside down. Like, you say you had your work, but do you think – are you sure it was good that you had your work?
It wasn't good. It was probably a distraction. You can't keep thinking about how terrible your life is. It's just you're going to be miserable, not even want to go to work or audition or anything. I guess I have a little bit of stick-to-itivity, practicality, go with the flow. My wife talks about me like that. She's very emotional because we're like totally different people, introvert, extrovert kind of thing. But she says at least I'm very low maintenance because I do roll with the punches. But you know her background with the...
Well, she's every bit the show business success that you are. She
absolutely more so now.
She created My So-Called Life, among other things. And,
of Wicked on Broadway.
Yeah, I wrote the book for Wicked. And
yeah. And she went on stage and they had it on TV somewhere. She makes a 3 or 4 minute speech. And the audience wasn't civilians. They were everybody who'd ever been in Wicked. 10 Elphabas. 15 Glendas, all the crew, everyone in the audience worked in the show. They were the audience. And New York went crazy for the anniversary of it. And in the Empire State Building, there was some lines from the play in red neon. And if you went to a cookie store, you'd get green cookies. Up and down Broadway, it was a big PR bonanza, you know. But that she first wrote My So-Called Life, which is a groundbreaking film, introducing Claire Danes. Now she's writing something else for Claire Danes. It's a pilot for a TV series.
When you describe your wife calling you low maintenance, and you describe yourself earlier in your life losing yourself in your work when you're dealing with this pain of your kids being gone,
mm-hmm.
Those are dad things where if you worked in a factory, they also wouldn't not apply to your dad. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Although I could play my dad in a factory. One of my favorite moments in Breaking Away is the clip you played of me walking on the campus. We go over after that and sit down on a stone bench, and I'm a stonemason. And Dennis Christopher, my son, is saying, I don't care if I get to college. The people in town call him a cutter because his dad's a stonemason. And that's a derogatory term. I don't care. I don't have to go to college. I don't mind being a cutter. And I look very serious and I say, you're not a cutter. I'm a cutter. One negative, one positive. And then I rub my hand on the stone bench like that. And in my book, I say, his hands remembered the stone he may have cut.
Do you think that you learned from playing these versions of your dad?
Well, I always, for some reason, I never, my father is not really there. And thinking at 10 or 12, everybody's dad's a little remote. In fact, a lot of guys at that time they worked in a factory, they came home, you know, that was their job. They didn't know very much their family, some of them. They weren't sensitive, let's say. They didn't have a pride in their children, you know. But I always, as I remember, I always felt forgiving. Even though I know I was deprived in some way, emotionally. And I wish, once I left home for college in New York, I wish I had the relationship with him where I could go back and say, I know we didn't spend as much time together as I would like to have, you know, to forgive him out loud and to tell him I regret that we didn't have that time together. I probably thought he wouldn't. He'd probably be frightened or threatened by it, bringing up something he obviously avoided. But I did borrow his solemnity, if you will. I'm pretty good playing parts that don't seem to have a lot of emotion. If required, I can have all kind of emotion. Look at the Fab commercials. In fact, over the top.
We got to go to a quick break. When we return, we will wrap up with the great Paul Dooley. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
The human mind can be tricky. Your mental health can be complex. Your emotional life can be complicated. So it helps to talk about it. I'm John Moe. Join me each week on my show, Depression Mode with John Moe. It's in-depth conversations about mental health with writers, musicians, comedians, doctors, and experts. Folks like Noah Kahn, Sashir Zameida, and Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. We talk about depression, anxiety, trauma, imposter syndrome, and perfectionism. We have the kind of conversations that a lot of folks are hesitant to have themselves. Listen, and you won't feel as alone, and you'll have some laughs, too. Depression Mode from Maximum Fun at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Paul Dooley, the star of Breaking Away, 16 Candles, and more, recently wrote a memoir called Movie Dad. You co-created and were head writer for The Electric Company. It's a very groundbreaking educational television show.
You got soup.
We got soup.
What kind of soup?
All kinds of soup. We got beet soup, that's a sweet soup. Then there's meat soup, parakeet soup, shredded wheat soup, and concrete soup. And the special today, dirty feet soup.
Dirty feet? Oh, forget about the soup. Let's see what you got in the menu here. You got sandwiches?
We got sandwiches.
What kind of sandwiches?
All kinds of sandwiches.
Did you get that job because you had been writing stuff like it for commercials?
Largely. Some agents sent me over to talk to them. We were looking at writers before we created the format. And I met with them. Tell us about your background. I said, well, I've done, frankly, hundreds of radio commercials, all humorous. And they said, well, we're, of course, dealing with short span of attention for children. You're not going to have a five-minute sketch, probably. The shorter, the better. If there's an animation piece, it was often a minute or 30 seconds. I said, so I'm used to working in short form, wordplay. And so they hired seven writers, and I was just one of many trying to create it. Then they would decide who might be the head writer. And I first used my ability, basically with puns, to create characters. I thought of a guy named Fargo North, decoder, comma. Because I'm sitting in a meeting with a bunch of reading experts, and they say, when a child learns to encode, meaning what the letters form the words, or decode, I'm sitting next to another writer, and I write in the margin of my handout, Fargo North, comma, decoder. He shows it to the producer. He said, well, let's make that a character that comes back every week or every other week or twice a week. Then I wrote a thing called Child Chef Julia Grownup, another pun. Oh, they love that. So I gave them already the characters who would be on the show. So after about six of these characters, Morgan Freeman played Easy Reader, who was Easy Writer. And there's a whole bunch of them, maybe a half a dozen. And then I got the idea for the title of the thing on that idea they have that when you get a good idea, it's a light bulb over your head, about the aha moment. I said, well, maybe it could be called The Electric Company. But I wasn't sure if I could use that. Then I went to the tail end of the show to have a bookend was still about electricity, called the last word. And you see a light bulb, and you see a word that says pull. Before it, you hear, it says pull, and give a kid a chance to read the word pull, putting two and two together. And if he doesn't hand it, a voice comes slightly after and said pull. The hand comes in, turns out the light, and the show. And you wouldn't believe this, but I did it every day, and I needed to have 130 of them for 130 episodes. And I discovered that I was a master of variations on a theme. A boxing glove turns out the light. Twins turn out the light. Wristwatch turns out the light. I don't know how, but I did 130 of them. Shaky. I've been very good at that, variations on the theme. I just, something in my head does that. It's a challenge, and I usually found ways of doing it. And that sort of bookended the show and gave it a title.
My comedy partner wrote on a late night show for a while called At Midnight and had to write, you know, 50 jokes a day or 100 jokes a day because it was like a comedy game show. So they just needed a lot of jokes. Mm-hmm. And it transformed his ability to write jokes. I mean, he's always been the funniest person.
It's an art, a craft.
And I imagine that working in advertising where you have to come up with 30 seconds that tells a story, shows the benefit of a product and has a call to action or whatever.
And a button, as we used to call it.
Over and over and over and over and over.
Well, the more you do it, the more you get better at it. But I guess you have to start with some pretty good a head for it. We used to have my partner was Andrew Duncan, also from Second City, and we were like two peas in a pod. And early on, we would look at what we created, and we didn't need to make a script out of it. We improvised it and remembered the best parts. But then they wanted to see the producers. They wanted to see a script. So as we're writing, we're trying to think, what is it we do that we can make into a script? And we found that what needs to happen is what we call copy points. That's about the product. And everything is building a story and characters. So it was almost like we would open with a couple of lines to tell them who we are and where we were, then a copy point, and then another who we are with a joke. And they take these jokes plus the copy points and thread them like this together. So one guy's always has to know everything about a product and the other guy has to know nothing. Otherwise, why are they talking? So it was a formula, really. And then we'd take something in the commercial that was a joke or a copy point and make it the blackout. Once we're doing there's an operation and you think it's a doctor and a male nurse. And talking to me, he says, have you heard about the new sale at the Buick dealership? He said, oh, yeah, I hear they have a lot of nice cars. And he said, we keep convincing one another. That's a great thing to do. So finally one guy says, I'm going to go over to my Buick dealer now and get a car. And he said, can you finish up? I mean, the operation. And the other guy says, yeah, but I don't know where my appendix is. So it's, you know, those jokes just leap out. But you do copy, 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 copy joke.
Well, thank you so much for all this time. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I love talking to you. And you know a lot about the business and a lot about comedy. So we're birds of a feather, really.
Paul Dooley, his book, Movie Dad, Finding Myself and My Family on Screen and Off, is available to buy at local bookstores and at bookshop.org. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here at my house, I missed garbage pickup day, and so my Christmas tree will live for one extra week. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by DJW, Dan Wally. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It was written and recorded by the Go Team. Our thanks to them and to their label, Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on Instagram at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We are also on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. With benefits kicking in as close as 100 miles from home, you can protect your travel plans whether you're driving across state lines or flying cross-country. Learn more at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.